have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. We have a very interesting conversation coming up in this hour. We start off with a piece done by Nadia Ramblagan, who is our production assistant. She went off and found historical recording of the day they put up the Jackson Lee Monument, and she built a program around that in terms of what happens to that monument. It's fascinating with her original coverage that she brings us. So enjoy this, and then after that, we'll hear from Stephanie Mavronis in a piece that she did 3 years ago about the monument, and my commentary on the Confederate monuments coming up. But check out this piece by Nadia Ramblagan. You'll enjoy it. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
In 2015, a young white man shot and killed 9 African-American men and women in a church in South Carolina. Pictures surfaced of the killer with Confederate flags. The horrific nature of the event almost immediately sparked a nationwide movement to remove symbols of the Confederacy from public spaces. In Baltimore, then-Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake convened a commission to decide the fate of the city's 4 Confederate monuments. One of these monuments is an enormous bronze statue of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Here is a story of how these 2 Southern Confederate generals became enshrined in one of Baltimore's public parks.
It starts with a recording that my friend Eric found of Dr. Douglas Southall Freeman giving a speech on May 1st, 1948, at the dedication of the statue.
So a friend of mine, like most of my friends, collect a whole bunch of bric-a-brac. And one friend of mine who I went to college with called me up and said, you know, I've had somebody come and look through my record collection and they've cherry-picked what they wanted. And I was wondering if you wanted to come and check through and see if there's anything that I had that you'd like to have. So I went over there. So I took the whole lot with me to the house, and as I was going through them and cataloging them, I ran across a few home recordings. Most of them were in 78, but this one was in 33 and a third and sparked my interest because it mentioned the date and it stated Dr. Freeman's speech at the dedication, Wyman Park.
Freeman was a historian of the Civil War and Robert E. Lee's biographer. And the Baltimoreans who put on the event were thrilled that he was speaking at what they felt was a momentous occasion.
Senator Radcliffe, Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ferguson, I dare say, when he set aside funds for this beautiful memorial, was interested primarily in the character and in the example set by Stonewall Jackson and by Robert E. Lee.
Over 3,000 people looked on as the statue was presented to the city on a May afternoon in 1948 in Wyman Park. Festivities included a parade and military band music. A Baltimore Sun article describes the Confederate flag scene, noting that hawkers outdoors peddled Confederate flags, sales being fairly good at $1 a flag. Virginia Military Institute cadets lined up on either side of the statue, donning their patent leather chin straps, gray coats, maroon sashes, and white linen trousers. Amongst a handful of important military guests, the governor and the mayor, the grandchildren of Lee and Jackson were also in attendance.
Okay, so it was Baltimore. May the 1st was unseasonably hot, and the roses were like lying like sad things over my little shoulder. They were so wilted.
Hi, my name is Clorinda Harris. I live in Baltimore. I live a few blocks from the Lee Jackson Memorial in Wyman Park. I was there when I was 9 years old, when it was dedicated, and my job was to put some roses that matched my dress, yellow, on the statue base.
This event was 20 years in the making. In 1928, J. Henry Ferguson Jr. donated $100,000, over $1.3 million in today's money, to the Municipal Arts Society of Baltimore for a statue of Lee and Jackson. In his will, Ferguson wrote, "They were my boyish heroes, and mature judgment has only strengthened my admiration for them. They were great generals and Christian soldiers. They waged war like gentlemen, and I feel that their example should be held up to the youth of Maryland."
In the story I now am about to tell you, however poorly it may be narrated, you will find more of excitement and thrill, more of high dramatic climax than ever were crowded, I suspect.
For Douglas Southall Freeman, the historian who dedicated the monument, these two generals were Southern identity. Lee and Jackson embodied the image of manliness and of selflessness. And so honoring them was honoring the idea of what it meant to be Southern as much as it was about honoring a person. Freeman's biographer, Dr. Keith Dixon, explains why men like Ferguson and Freeman worked so hard to glorify these two men in particular, and why the statue of Lee and Jackson in Baltimore, which depicts both men on horses at their last meeting before battle, strikes such a powerful chord with many Southerners.
My name's Keith Dixon, and I am the author of Sustaining Southern Identity, Douglas Southall Freeman in Memory in the Modern South, published by Louisiana State University Press. Lee and Jackson are the key elements of collective identity, Southern collective identity. The idea of honor, humility, sacrifice, Christian soldiers.
Like Freeman, J. Henry Ferguson Jr. believed in the lost cause, the movement that created and perpetuated a pro-Confederate interpretation of the Civil War.
That is the intent of the monument. That's the intent of the words, is to convey over time to generations in the future that this is what we Southerners collectively, want you, the future generations, want to understand about who we are, what's important to us, and why it's so important.
This narrative is not what we acknowledge today, that Lee and Jackson fought for the continuation of an immoral society based on the enslavement of some for the economic prosperity of others.
The creation of the monument was overseen by a committee that was made up of Ferguson's friends, including R. E. Lee Marshall, a Baltimore City lawyer and the grandson of a Confederate general who served with Lee. Ferguson's donation would only be available to the Municipal Arts Society when his sister, Ella F. Ward, died. In November of 1934, 6 years after Ferguson's death and 1 month after the death of his sister, the Committee for the Monument held a first meeting. By 1935, the Ferguson Committee had selected the location on Wyman Park Drive and decided to hold a competition, inviting six sculptors to submit designs for the monument. One of those six was a sculptor named Laura Garden Fraser.
She came to Baltimore from her studio in Connecticut to view the site. She immediately saw in this park, in Baltimore, the battlefield at Chancellorsville.
A little after 7, they met there at the crossroads. Lee was on Traveller, quiet as always, his cloak about him. Jackson on Little Sorrel, an ugly, ill-bred horse whom Miss Fraser is flattered in that picture. Jackson already. The column moving down the road to the Catherine Furnace. Jackson preparing to take the lead. And then they spoke a few words. Jackson pointed down the road. And then it disappeared like a Norse god in the forest.
Garden Fraser won the competition. For the next 5 years, Laura Garden Fraser worked on the statue. She had gone to the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond to study the men's uniforms, the canteens dangling from their belts, and the equipment on the horses. She had visited the battlefield at Chancellorsville to feel the scene she was trying to create. She went to Washington, D.C. to study and evaluate equestrian statues. She read biographies of Lee and Jackson and histories of the Civil War, not only to understand the men, but the lore and traditions that surrounded them. Only after all the research was done did the process of sculpting begin.
At 14 feet tall, the horses and men had to be worked on in pieces and then put together. She would climb on scaffolds to delicately carve the faces, and then sit diligently to mold the muscles and the tendons of the horses to just the right shape. She would work and then rework a section to get the exact look she wanted from all angles. She would roll the clay model out of the studio into the sun to see how the shadows cast affected her work. The work was slow, she was obsessed with detail and with making it absolutely perfect.
When I found a June 1936 Baltimore Sun article titled, "Objections to a Statue," I figured someone was making a real comment about why this monument should be abandoned before it was even built. I can't quite tell the intent of the satirical drawing with the caption, "Summary of the objections raised to date to the Lee Jackson Monument to be placed in Wyman Park." Reason number one, the whole monument should be condemned because the cause of the South was a disgraceful one.
Clearly, someone had made that comment, but whoever was writing this piece seemed to think that the argument against even erecting the statue was as silly as saying that the hats were wrong or that the faces were too idealistic. The city, the Municipal Arts Society, and everyone officially involved with the monument kept the process moving, complaints or not. The construction of the statue was held up during World War II, since the scarcity of metal meant bronze couldn't be used to cast Lee and Jackson. And this could have been the real point at which the whole project was given up on. It took 20 years for the Lee Jackson Monument to finally be completed. And during those 20 years, someone could have said, "This is a bad idea," or even just questioned why a monument to two Confederate generals was being erected in Baltimore. That didn't happen.
Instead, the finished statue was loaded into a truck with 20 wheels that got held up in Philadelphia because it didn't have the right permit. On the way to Baltimore, it was too tall to go under a bridge, and the air of all of the truck's tires had to be let out. Eventually, the statue arrived at its new home.
In 1948, the Lee Jackson statue was dedicated. Baltimore City opened new segregated schools and public facilities, such as whites-only swimming pools.
1948 is an interesting date in residential history. There are restrictive covenants that were making certain neighborhoods, like Roland Park, like Guilford, you know, if you were Black or Jewish, you couldn't buy into those neighborhoods. So 1948 is actually the year that the Supreme Court rules that unconstitutional.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Nix, professor of history at the University of Baltimore and a member of the special commission that was put together to review Baltimore's Confederate monuments. During the review process, the commission held public hearings to invite input from the community.
That was an amazing period. We had these hearings in the city hall, and so it was standing room only for the hearing where everyone got to speak.
Over 100 people testified. One 13-year-old girl talked about what it was like to live across the street from the Lee Jackson Monument.
Every year, the Sons of Confederate Veterans hold a commemoration at the Lee Jackson statue. They come in full battle dress and with all of the flags of the Confederacy. They pledge to the flag. They sing Dixie. They try to rewrite history, she said.
And she was in tears as she was testifying.
The commission ultimately decided that the Lee Jackson Monument should be removed, deaccessioned, and offered to the National Park Service to be placed at the Chancellorsville battlefield.
This hasn't happened, mainly because the National Park Service doesn't want it, and moving the monument anywhere would be expensive. We talked with another member of the commission, Elisa Blount Moorhead, at her office in the Motor House off North Avenue, where you can hear buses outside. Miss Blount Moorhead voted to keep the monument.
She's an artist, a film producer, and lives here in Baltimore with her family.
My general reason for wanting to keep those monuments is because I fundamentally don't believe in deaccessioning grotesque memory. And I think the Lost Cause is a grotesque concept. I think it's, it was a bastardized conversation around really slavery and all of the sort of romanticized ideas around slavery and subjugation of my people. I'm really clear on that. There was a moment in the hearings where I think the people who were pro-Confederacy thought somehow I was aligned with them because I would want to keep that, and I want to, and I tried to help them understand that without, like, compromising my alleged objectivity. I don't know how objective I am, but really, as art objects, obviously there's value, and there's some, detached connection to the formal things around creating work, and specifically one of the monuments was created by a female artist, which is something to mark. It is important. You could look at materiality, you can do all of that work, right? But at the end of the day, I'm really trying to focus on art as a spark for cultural memory. And so the reason I think that they should stay in place is because I think destroying them destroys a very ugly memory. And that memory, to me, informs very much the politics that we live in right now and the Trump era and the way that the world is now resurrecting the Confederate flag and resurrecting all the memory attached to the Confederate flag. And I think that happens when you try to either suppress it, erase it, or not contextualize it.
Elisa believes that the statue should be challenged consistently through public art, whether that's installations, light projection, film, alterations to the statue, or even just speeches.
To me, speech is art. So, I think, whether it's through speech or whatever, if they're not going to do that around the statues, then I think it's worth it to go back and start to rethink what should happen.
New Orleans, Charlottesville, and other cities across the U.S. are grappling with the issue of what to do with Confederate monuments. Is allowing Lee and Jackson to remain in Baltimore with only a plaque a win for white supremacy?
Simply removing the statue doesn't erase history, and erasing history doesn't help us deal with the present.
I hope you enjoyed that piece, produced by Nadia Ramlagan and Christina Gatti. You can find more information about that work and their work at leejacksonmonument.weebly.com.